Right, Cabinet today agreed to publication of the Government response to the New Zealand aquaculture industry strategy, and the Government response will be released in the first week in June when the new aquaculture industry body is being launched. It's Jim Anderton's area. Secondly, agreed to extend the deployment of the two New Zealand Defence Force military liaison officers who are serving in East Timor for a 12-month period up to the end of June, if the United Nations mission is extended as long as that, which there's probably every prospect it would be. We've agreed on the next steps in the land transport sector review, a review Mrs. King's been carrying out on roles and functions in the sector, and she is likely to announce decisions on that next week. Also finalised the policy for the land transport management transport services licensing bill. That is the legislation Mrs. King has briefed on in recent weeks around regional councils' procurement of public passenger transport. Taken decisions around the next phases of the pay and employment equity plan of action in the public sector. This is a process which Ruth Dyson is overseeing as Minister of Labour. We've been through phase one and now moving on to phases two and three. Had more discussion around the work on the use of planning mechanisms to achieve more affordable housing, and we'll be looking at firm options in late June with another paper from Chris Carter around that. Agreed today on the policy for a bill on data matching between Ministry of Social Development and Corrections to absolutely ensure that we can stop benefits being wrongly paid for those imprisoned. We've also agreed on improvements to NCEA going forward. There were some outstanding issues to be acted on. We've made decisions about that, and the Minister of Education will no doubt have decisions to announce there. And we've also been determining policy for a bill which will amend the Corrections Act relating to drugs, contraband and seizure of powers, which will be strengthened. Now, we've also looked today at where legislation relating to gangs might go. Everyone's aware that the Proceeds of Crime Bill is in front of Parliament at the present time. But we've also flagged in the past week, when this issue's been very much in the headlines, that the hopes which had been held for Section 98A of the Crimes Act, which is about participation in organised criminal groups, has not been realised. Section 98A was introduced into the law in 1997 when the previous government decided to toughen up on gangs. Unfortunately, under that version of the law, only two convictions were ever procured, and I understand that in that case the people concerned pleaded guilty. So it's very easy to get a conviction when people plead guilty. But apart from that, convictions weren't able to be procured. In 2002, Section 98A was tightened further, and the police have taken a number of prosecutions and initially appeared to get some convictions, but have found it hard going in recent times. So we are asking that the Justice Department have another look at Section 98A in the coming weeks to see if we can make it more effective. We've also asked officials to come back to us taking a fresh look at the law around consorting and association and on intimidation. And with respect to intimidation, to look at whether strengthened law there could then deal with issues like the wearing of gang paraphernalia and other forms of gang identification which are found by members of the public to be intimidating. I think many people who've seen some of the sights on television in recent times of people with the hoods and the bandanas virtually completely covering a face would agree that there are circumstances where that is grossly intimidating. And as I mentioned last week, the police in Whangarei actually did make three arrests and charge in cases where that was the case. So we're looking at how the law might be able to be improved in those areas and really whether we can take some fresh approaches there. It is, of course, an offence under Section 6A of the Summary Offences Act to associate habitually with a violent offender in circumstances from which it can reasonably be inferred that the association will lead to the commission of a crime involving violence by that person or any such offender. But no charge can be laid unless the person has been warned three times, and that provision requires intent of a sort. Our law does have similar provisions making it an offence to associate with serious drug offenders and with convicted thieves. Both have similar future criminal activity requirements. So the law in this area is quite complex, but we are taking a closer look around intimidation, around consorting, and around strengthening the participation in organised criminal groups, which was intended to be covered since 1997, but it's been quite difficult to make charges stick. Now, other announcements. We have arriving next Sunday evening late in New Zealand, the Prime Minister of Greece, for a short visit, the first ever by a Greek Prime Minister to New Zealand. We're welcoming the visit. He will call on the Governor General, on me, meet with the Cabinet. There will be a state luncheon, wreath laying at the Tomb of the Unknown Warrior. The friendship between New Zealand and Greece is a strong one. It goes back to New Zealand's extraordinary efforts in the defence of Greece from Nazi Germany's forces during the Second World War, leading to the retreat through Greece and the epic Battle of Crete. And it so happens that the Greek Prime Minister does arrive on the 20th of May, which is the exact anniversary of the beginning of the Battle of Crete. In modern times, the relationship with Greece is particularly important because of its membership of the European Union, and we value having good friends in the European Union, which itself overall is a good partner. The other statement from me is to very much welcome, on behalf of Labour, the announcement which the Foreign Minister has made today about lifting overseas aid levels. This delivers on our election pledge of 2005 to raise official development assistance to 0.35% of gross national income by 2010. So this implements that pledge of 2005. Obviously, the key priority for assistance is and continues to be the Pacific region, and there's a great deal more New Zealand can do. And we've welcomed the support from New Zealand First for this move, and also the consistent advocacy of the Green Party. This objective was actually mentioned in the cooperation agreement we signed with the Green Party after the last election. Now, what's coming up in the House this week? We have the third reading of the Social Security Entitlement Cards Amendment, Mr. Peter's bill on the gold card. We have the second reading of Trevor Mallard's bill on state-owned enterprises, AgriQuality and Assure. And we have the committee stages continuing of the Social Security Amendment Bill in the name of David Benson Pope. Wednesday is Members' Day. And then Thursday, of course, will be taken up with the budget. Coming up this week, obviously, there's been budget statements on official development assistance today. Rick Barker making one on civil defence improvements at a conference today also. The photo with Michael Cullen and Stand Up some of you have been at in the last hour or so. We have tomorrow announcements up at Cape Reinga about spending there, and a pre-budget announcement from Jim Anderton on the biosecurity area. Later in the week, we're expecting an announcement to be made on the new Telecommunications Commissioner, and also a Families Commission report is expected on difficulties faced by mothers with multiple sclerosis. Thursday budget, Friday post-budget speeches. I will do the one I've done every year as Prime Minister to the Auckland Chamber of Commerce. Michael Cullen will have one with the Wellington Chamber of Commerce. Also Friday there will be public release, I believe, of a discussion document on Auckland governance from the Central Local Government Steering Group, which has been working on where to take Auckland governance. Saturday, New Zealand time, will be the funeral of the Samoan head of state, His Highness Malietoa. I expect to go up to that with the Governor-General, and we're looking at transport options at the moment. Both the 757s are out of flying because of scheduled maintenance at the present time, so there will be transport by Hercules, which will be rather limited, obviously. And it may well be that media would want to consider whether they take an early flight with Air New Zealand, which is putting on a much bigger plane, I understand, early on Friday morning. But people who are interested should discuss that with my office. Right, any questions?
Prime Minister, you want to investigate vaccine by Ian Wishart. Was there anything in there that gives you a concern about how it broad, or in fact any of your Labour colleagues are accused of a so-called cover-up?
Well, firstly, I haven't paid any great attention to the article. I'm well aware of the nature of this journal and the kind of muckraking that it does. I can advise you of several things. Firstly, the Commissioner of Police has referred all of it to Judge Lowell Goddard, the Police Complaints Authority, for her to pick up as she deems fit. Secondly, with respect to Mr. Broad, he seems to have become the focus of Mr. Wishart's attention because he's a person in authority. And Mr. Wishart specialises in tackling tall poppies, as I can say from personal experience. I have been on the public record with my comments about Mr. Broad, who I have confidence in. In my view, it is not credible to hold against someone something that happened in his house without his approval when he was 23 years old, 26 years ago. And I think it's extraordinary to suggest that there should be action taken on such a matter. The third issue, I understand, is around various allegations that Labour members in Dunedin were given evidence of wrongdoing by the police. I have had voice mail messages from the Minister of Health, who's at the WHO meetings in Geneva. They tell me that Mr. Idor, a man known to those who follow conspiracy theorists, who talks big and seldom delivers, if ever, Mr. Idor has approached Dunedin members with various allegations. Their approach has been to say, give us the evidence, and evidence is not forthcoming. Mr. Idor pointed in the direction of a certain woman prisoner in Christchurch. Mr. Hodgson, as a conscientious member, then asked Mr. Barnett, a conscientious Christchurch member, if he would go to interview said prisoner in Christchurch prison, which Mr. Barnett, to his credit, did on two occasions. He spoke at length to the prisoner. He found her somewhat confusing, and she was not prepared to put her name to any evidence. I understand from Mr. Barnett that he and Mr. Hodgson met the Minister of Police, but decided it was very difficult to take things further when people were making wild allegations and you could not get any substantiation because people would not put their name to them. Now, it may well be that as the Commissioner of Police is referring all of this to the Police Complaints Authority, that she can shed some light on it. And beyond that, it's really a little difficult for me to comment. Mr. Barnett is here if you wish to have any more detail from him.
But so far, do you know why the Commissioner, and do you think it's advisable for the Commissioner to do so, to hand it over to the PCA?
I think the Commissioner is a very upfront man, and he has said, look, these allegations are made, send it off to the PCA, see what she will make of it.
Do you think if a member of the public went to one of your MPs today, knowing what we know now,
and alleged corruption and misconduct in the Dunedin police that they might be listened to?
Well, they were listened to, but no one would put their name to the allegations.
You would expect someone to actually start inquiries, though.
Well, inquiries were initiated by Mr. Hodgson to the point of having a senior member of parliament interview someone who it was said would put their name to it. But yes, that just didn't lead anywhere. Now, at the end of the day, members of parliament aren't sleuths. You know, they're not detectives. And before you put something in the hands of the police, you need to have, you know, some feeling that you're not wasting their time. And there is a problem when people won't actually put their name to allegations.
But are you satisfied that Mr. Hawkins wasn't just flannelled by the police headquarters when he or he...
Look, you'd have to pursue that with Mr. Hawkins, but what I know from Mr. Barnett is there was a discussion between the three men concerned, the two who'd been listening to the allegations, couldn't get evidence, and I think they felt that there simply wasn't enough to go on.
Is there any concern about crossover to the Bain case here? There seems to be allegations made by Joe Karen today that there's some sort of deficiencies or negligence or worse from the Dunedin police at the time, and this may have had an impact on that. Are you concerned about any of that?
Well, I really don't have any brief on that at all. I really wouldn't have any comment to offer on it.
Do you think Mr. Broad should have perhaps declared that those sorts of incidents and past culture of the Dunedin police to Dame Margaret Baisley?
Well, I don't really have an opinion on that. I think you should put the question to him. You know, we're talking 26 years ago, a 23-year-old, rather lowly police officer. I think it's sort of with the benefit of hindsight, you might think all sorts of things. Let's be clear, you know, it's completely unacceptable by the standards of 1981 and the standards of 2007 for police to watch such videos. And if it happened today, it would undoubtedly be reported to superiors and action would be taken. We know from Dame Margaret's report that things were much less satisfactory in the past. However, I accept Mr. Broad's word that he didn't approve of them being shown and in fact was concerned that they were.
Do you know whether Mr. Idor had any other involvement with this story by Mr. Isham?
Well, I think that's a question that should be put directly to Mr. Idor. Was he there? Did he see the video? Did he play any role in it being shown? Those are all questions you should put to him.
Do you have any information that he was there?
Well, there are suggestions all around, but I think you should raise it directly with him.
Has the Commissioner given any indications, or the Police Minister given any indications, on whether Wayne Idor was present?
Well, those are questions you'll have to put to them. But Mr. Idor obviously was a police officer there at the time and may well have been there.
Has any consideration been given to taking legal action against Ian Wishart and Investigate magazine, and if not, why not?
Well, as one of the people whose family has been most maligned by him, I haven't initiated action because I really have better things to do with my money. And I really think that his technique is to try to get mainstream media running off after all kinds of wild allegations. And unfortunately in our society, when anyone chucks an allegation at a prominent public figure or their family, the allegation becomes headlines with no thought given to how hurtful that might be to the person concerned or their family, and that is a distressing thing.
However, he was correct about the bestiality film being shown at Mr. Ball's house, so why would he not be correct about the child sex ring cover-up having gone on underneath?
Well, it's drawing a long bow, and of course the whole point of his raising the issue of that video was to try and somehow find Mr. Broad culpable for it being shown, and I accept Mr. Broad's word that he wasn't.
Given Mr. Idle's connections, do you see the hand of the Exclusive Brethren Church in any of this?
We have to ask the question of who funds these sorts of investigations. Who funds Investigate magazine? Who prints it? Who pays for Mr. Idle to run around? Those are all questions that the media could legitimately raise.
Thank you.
Do you accept that your party is behind the polls?
Do I accept it?
Yes.
Well, I see polls. I see polls of various kinds, which suggest that. It's not a new phenomenon, by the way. I've been Prime Minister for 7.5 years. I remember the winter of discontent. I remember Orewa, where it ran for around 6 months. That's quite a significant problem. I remember post-budget 2005, and I also remember winning 3 elections in a row.
Just touching on the cabinet discussion about the gang issue, what is your objective at reviewing that particular section? I mean, do you foresee a period where you wouldn't implement gang patches because it's a form of intimidation?
Well, there's a couple of things here. The Section 98A at the present time does make it an offence for an individual to participate in an organised criminal group. However, there's a lot of qualifications around that. For example, the individual must know it is an organised criminal group. Well, that's probably a test that's reasonably easy to meet. Secondly, the individual must know or be reckless as to whether his or her participation contributes to the occurrence of criminal activity. Now, you can see immediately hearing that where a defence lawyer can introduce doubt. And then thirdly, it has to be proved that the group must have an objective of either obtaining material benefits from the commission of offences, punishable by 4 or more years imprisonment, or the commission of serious violent offences for 10 years imprisonment in or out of New Zealand. Now, it was designed to crack down on gangs by making association convictions easier to obtain. On the other hand, it was also designed to ensure that simply being with criminals would not in itself give rise to a conviction. There had to be a criminal intent or recklessness as to criminality. Now, the issue is whether in today's circumstances that is good enough. The issue is whether we take a fresh look at consorting, a fresh look at intimidation, whether the fresh look at intimidation can then bring into question the way in which people are attired, which makes them appear menacing, threatening and intimidating. So those are the issues we're putting the spotlight on.
So is it therefore possible that gang patches could be banned?
What I'm saying is we're looking at these issues in the context of the law around intimidation. We are looking, for example, at where the local government has the powers, needs the powers, would like the powers, whether the police have the powers to stop such behaviour, such wearing of such paraphernalia or identifying clothing, whether that's possible within the law at the moment or whether it should be changed. And you can immediately see where you get the problems with it. For example, difficulties of drafting, how to distinguish between gangs on the one hand and other groups who dress in particular ways. So it does come, I think, down to the issue of intimidation. Is the way in which people are dressed and behaving intimidating? We are asking officials to take a fresh look at all of this.
So, I mean, most people would regard gang patches as intimidating.
The objective is to crack down on intimidating behaviour. As I said last week, there were 3 arrests in Whangarei in April where people in a mall felt intimidated by people strutting around with their gang clothing and paraphernalia. And personally, when I see sights on television of people hooded and with bandanas hiding just about everything except their eyes, and people know that to be gang uniform, you could imagine the intimidating effect that has on people in a public place. So we are bound to take a fresh look at these issues, and we are.
Couldn't you run into a problem, though, when you get a situation like, say, the Enough is Enough march, where people are wearing T-shirts that identify themselves as belonging to a church and maybe making gestures that people along the street find intimidating?
Yes, you exactly identify some of the difficulties with moving in this area. But we are bound to look to see whether police powers to stop intimidating behaviour are sufficient at the present time.
On the Bain case, would you consider, rather than letting the judicial process sort of run its course now, would you consider intervening in the same way that Melbourne did with the Thomas case and appointing an independent QC to look at all the evidence freshly?
No, there's been no consideration of that, and that isn't the direction from the Privy Council either. The Privy Council quashed the conviction and has sent the matter back to New Zealand for consideration of a retrial, and we have not considered intervening in that process at all. This is something that has moved through the court system to the highest appellate court pertaining to the Bain case. It now comes back to New Zealand to the Solicitor General to make a decision, and he will want to study the Privy Council decision very carefully before he makes that decision.
Do you think that a retrial would be fairest in that it would that the decision undermines confidence in the justice system, which might be repressed by retrial?
I don't think it's appropriate for me to offer an opinion on what the appropriate course is. It's very important that I, as Prime Minister, not be seen to in any way direct the Solicitor General in his statutory duty, nor to make comments which might impact on a retrial if one were ordered. So I really am not prepared to venture into expressing an opinion on this.
Prime Minister, would the government consider further assistance for the victims or the people that witnessed the Christmas Island nuclear test, because the Operation Grapple Veterans Day, so they had further scientific evidence that showed there was chromosome defects as a result of their attendance, and they were calling particularly for further assistance of the children of the test veterans?
Well, firstly, the government actually contributed financially towards the research that has been done. And we haven't had the opportunity to have a close look at it or have any peer review. Let me say, for my part, it would be incredible to think that damage was not done to people's health by being ordered to stand on the deck of a frigate in the vicinity of an atmospheric nuclear test. The question is what damage and what nature of it. Was it a health effect at the time, or did it do the sort of damage that this study appears to be pointing towards? So what the Minister has said today is that we've made a commitment to monitor the research done here and internationally on the health of the nuclear test veterans. We now need to consider the research. And in the interim, we encourage any nuclear test veteran who has a disability that they believe is attributable to or aggravated by their service to apply for a war disablement pension. And of course, if such a pension is awarded, then all medical care for the disability is fully funded. But certainly the research is of great interest, and we now need to study it further.
Veterans seem to want to have more research done on their children. Do you support that? Would the government consider putting money into that?
Well, that's something we would be looking for advice on. As I say, we have contributed financially to this research because we'd all like to know the truth about what happened. By today's standards, obviously it's simply extraordinary that people were ordered to stand on the deck of a frigate and witness an atmospheric test. And it would be hard, as I say, to believe there were not health effects. The issue's always been, did those health effects become chromosomal effects? Do they have implications down through the generations? Were they transitory effects? And the research has thrown up some very interesting findings.
John Howard has stepped in to stop the cricket tour in Zimbabwe by the Australian team. Does his action lead you to reconsider the way you acted last time with that next time?
Well, firstly, I understand the Australian directive to its national cricket team was backed by the government being prepared to cancel passports under the Australian Passports Act. Now, their Act has a much broader discretion than ours to cancel passports. We don't have that power in our Act, and what I'm advised is that New Zealand would have had to specifically legislate to cancel passports to stop people going to South Africa, to Zimbabwe. Now, that is not a choice that we made to go down that track. New Zealand law currently does circumscribe authorities on when a passport can be cancelled. Of course, we have authority over who comes into New Zealand, so we were able, with an existing law, to ban the Zimbabwe team making a return visit. Clearly, the situation, while bad in Zimbabwe at the time the New Zealand cricketers toured, is considerably worse now, and that is something the Zimbabwean government may have taken into account. But it's also fair to say that the International Cricket Council may have shifted its position a little as well.
Would you like to have those powers that the Australian government has to start with?
Well, I think that's not a straightforward issue, because we New Zealanders value our freedom to travel. Now, we don't have a tradition of cancelling passports for these kinds of reasons, and I think there would be quite a lot of public debate about that.
Do you mean like the ICC must have told Australia that they wouldn't find them?
Correct.
Whereas you were under the understanding that they would have found them.
Unless we had passed legislation which directed that they not tour. Now, the Australian government clearly was able to use the Passports Act. It didn't come to that, presumably because it was sufficiently clear to the Australian Cricket Council that the Australian government did have the power within existing law to stop it. So they stopped it.
So surely if the New Zealand government said to New Zealand Cricket that we don't want you to go and you should not go.
That's what we said, and they went.
Well,
there was a resolution in Parliament expressing great concern about the tour, but we did not have legislation we could use to stop it. We would have had to pass a special Act of Parliament. And I repeat, as presently enacted, our Passports Act does not authorise the withholding or cancellation of a passport on grounds such as morality or protection of the rights and freedoms of others.
John, tax cuts, we made it clear this morning that there'd be no personal tax cuts in the budget. What about election year?
Oh, no doubt you've been over all these issues with Dr. Cullen today. I don't think I can offer anything more on top of that.
Prime Minister, how long is the Greek Prime Minister here?
He comes in on Sunday evening, and he will be going out later in the day on Monday, after the official luncheon and after meeting with the Greek community. So it's a short visit, but obviously he's either coming from or going to Australia. He'll be out around 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Thank you.